Well, hello, and welcome back to the Deonandi podcast. I'm Dr. Ray Watt Deonandi, global health epidemiologist. Today's episode is a live lecture that I gave to a PhD class at the Institute for Population Health at the University of Ottawa. And the topic is paradigms of public health. So what are some of the philosophical constructs that define the way we think about population and public health? If you want to see the slides that I presented, go to my website, deonandin.com, click on podcast, find this episode, and there will be a link to a PDF of these slides. In the meantime, I hope you enjoy the presentation. Recording. Okay. So before I begin, I'm an Anglophone, and I know some of you are probably Francophone, so I will try to speak very slowly, and I will probably get excited and speed up and mumble. So if you want me to slow down again, put your hand up, I will try to slow down. And how many of you would consider yourselves to be quantitative specialists, people who work with numbers? Anybody? Okay. How many consider yourselves to be qualitative specialists? One, two. Or people who's more
experts,
or whose greater comfort is in the qualitative world. All right, so that sort of discounts my next question, which is how many of you consider yourselves to be epidemiologists? Probably none. Oh, is there one? Yes? Yeah? No? All right, interesting. That's good. That's good, because that means a lot of what I'll talk about today was probably be new. And you know what epidemiology is, right, I assume, because you have those readings. And Sani has sent me the readings earlier this week. Told me, hey, come talk about whatever you want. All right. And when I read those readings, what kept popping out at me was what they really are investigations of paradigm shifts, and how the paradigm that describes the quantitative world, which dominates much of what we think about as describing evidence, relevance, maybe is not the complete picture. Okay, so have you done any discussions on the paradigms of research? You've done already? Okay, so I can skip those slides over. That's fantastic. Well, I'll skim over fast, and we'll get to something that's a bit more relevant to epidemiology. And even though I prepared these slides last night, we're not tied to them. So please feel free to distract me and make this a discussion, because I don't want to talk about it. So do we have a clicker? You're the clicker. Oh, right on. So here, because you're all experts already in paradigms, I'll just go over this quickly. What's a paradigm? When I ask our grad students, they have no idea, because they're not trained in the... Yeah. He says, as the audience... For the audio audience, I snagged my cable on a chair. I feel foolish now. So a paradigm is a set of beliefs, right? And we all live in certain kinds of paradigms, and often we're not aware of them. And one of the problems in my discipline, which is epidemiology and to a large extent public health, is we don't investigate or acknowledge the fact we live in a sphere of assumptions and, more importantly, values. And that's my recurring theme always, is values. What aspect of my personal biases have actually come into how I interpret numbers, which is fascinating. I'll give you some examples of how numbers actually can be swayed by personal value and belief. But you all know this stuff already, right? And the founder of how we think about paradigmatic thought in science tends to be Thomas Kuhn, the philosopher. Next slide, please. What's all this? Oh, text, endless text. You know about the three categories of belief systems that tend to define paradigms: ontology, which is, you know, what am I? What is this? What is this thing? You know, like how do I know what's real and so forth? And epistemology is, how do I know how I know what's real? How did this information come to me? And oftentimes, in my opinion, this is where the public health domain kind of falls flat, is we don't take the time to really investigate how this information came to us. We do in the sense of methodology, but not in the sense of how it was filtered through value. And lastly, methodology. That's the obvious way that public health practitioners question the value of evidence, is we say this was not sampled correctly, it was not computed correctly, but we rarely take that additional step to consider, again, the filter, the personal filter, the human filter. Next slide, please. Again, this is all review for you. Just this is a quick summary of the two largest categories of research paradigms. For some reason, the person I stole the slide from called the second one a naturalist. I would also call it post-positivist. I believe some of the papers call it post-positivist. And in general, the biggest distinctive features of these is the positive approach talks about a real world that I can access and measure, make predictions about, that is tangible and understandable. And the other paradigm, is someone trying to get in? Yeah. Strange face. There's a face at the door. We all see that, right? Not just me? Okay. And it's like, hi. It's my handsome face. He saw it through the window and he wants to come in and have a good look. And the other paradigm here is called naturalist. Again, some people call them post-positivists, or the other category of paradigms talks about how there is a relationship between the observer and the observed. I like saying it that way because my background is actually in physics. And physics just loves this stuff because the quantum revolution just told us, oh my God, there's no way to actually objectively measure reality without affecting the thing that you're measuring. Next slide, please. Okay, so again, common paradigms, you've seen this already, but I'll throw them out at you. The interpretivist one is one, three, and four are kind of all the same. There's subtle differences. Five is the one that's very popular in this campus, feminist paradigm, which talks about one, three, and four, but also the role of gender and all of this. But I draw your attention to number two, which is what most people think about as being science, as this idea that, again, there is objective reality. And I struggle with this idea. I watch so many documentaries on parallel universes and how we know what's real and whether or not the meson subparticles actually are virtual or real, and that my mind is like, nothing's real. I can't be sure I'm here right now, which is why I don't bother sleeping. Well, I sleep. I'm not entirely 100% sure you guys are here right now. I could be imagining all this. You could be imagining me. I don't care. It doesn't matter. Because either way, I'll be giving this talk. But the important part is the distinction between what most people consider to be science as being somehow sacrosanct and what we in this room probably accept already as being somewhat a softer definition of the ways in which investigation interrelates with societal process. Next slide, please. Right. So, again, jumping around, paradigm dictates what we study, the type of questions that we ask, and the exact structure and nature of questions. Even though I've been kind of, airy-fairy so far about distinction between reality and what's not real and personal belief, number two is really how the problem in public health of defining a paradigm kind of manifests. It affects the kinds of questions we allow ourselves to ask. So value, as the obvious way that value interjects in our investigations. Is it okay for me to ask this probably ethically problematic question over here? Who's going to judge me? Will my colleagues judge me? Of course they will. I'm going to show you an example later on of one of the most important public health questions asked in your lifetimes, which is, does smoking cause cancer? And there are subcategories in that question that we're not allowed to ask, or at least to investigate, for good reasons. Those have to do with ethics and how we think about a proper society. And that springs forth from our paradigm again, which is not just about how we define reality, but how we define ethical behavior in reality. So as researchers, what are we allowed to look at? Next question, please. Next slide, please, rather. Oh, coffee. Okay. So we have this thing called a paradigm shift. And a paradigm shift happens when enough errors accumulate or problems accumulate in our current paradigm that eventually we say, you know what, this is just way too wrong. We have to move on to a new set of beliefs and systems. It would be nice if we didn't have a set of beliefs and systems, that if there was true objective reality, but there isn't, in my opinion and in the opinion of the people who purvey this kind of thinking. So I believe that in public health and medicine, we're actually on the verge of a new paradigm shift. I'm not sure what it looks like yet, but we'll talk a bit about that, time permitting. Can you think of some big paradigm shifts in science that have happened that are famous?
The Earth is flat.
The Earth is flat. Okay. You know, that's a funny one, because the paradigm shift there wasn't the belief from the flat Earth to the spherical Earth. It was our modern acceptance of when that shift happened. Because the ancient Greeks knew the Earth was round. In fact, all through the Middle Ages, they knew it as well. Just somehow, some writers wrote about the flat Earth. Columbus knew it was round. Everyone knew it was round. What they didn't know was how big it was. So the ways in which we even perceive the history of paradigms is skewed by value. There are political forces that tainted the way that story was told. So, and that's also a depiction of value. I'm off on a tangent. Other examples. Good example. Sure. That's a more subtle intellectual answer, right? I did not expect that answer. That's a very highbrow answer. Yeah. You guys are so pointy-headed intellectual. That is a paradigm shift, absolutely. I'm looking for the obvious ones you learn in grade school, maybe. Yeah.
Relativity.
Okay, that's a great one. As a physicist, that's a great one because we had the world of Newton, Newtonian physics, which is very predictable and very stable and standard, and that gave way to the Einsteinian world where there's relativity. And the interesting part of that shift was it happened during World War I, World War II. When the Germans were the enemies and the British still worshipped Newton. So Newton's truth was all-pervading. And to allow that shift, it took a remarkable case of political and personal will. There was one gentleman in particular, his name was Eddington. He was a scientist in England who put aside his political and patriotic beliefs and accepted Einstein's theories. And in fact, the government had told him his job is to disprove Einstein because Einstein posed a threat to British value at the time of war, right? But because of the heft of evidence that the experiment shows, eventually we had to accept Einstein's system. Now ask yourself, if Einstein was a Nazi, would this have been accepted in the same amount of time? It turned out he was very sympathetic towards the Allied cause, and he was embraced by the Americans and the British. So I would suggest that maybe those political forces accelerated the adoption of relativity over Newtonian physics. Another example. Germ theory is a good one, absolutely, yeah. So, and that's actually a good segue because germ theory replaced miasma theory. The miasma theory was this idea that this mysterious gas, sometimes pervaded by an odor, right, was what caused disease. And finally, we discovered little guys living in samples, and that's what now we believe caused the disease. Maybe that'll give way in 50 years to something more esoteric. All these energy healers and things like that, we mock them in epidemiology. Maybe they're onto something. I don't know, right? We'll talk a little bit about that. We talk about randomized controlled trials. So it's entirely possible that we're on the verge of some other shift of a belief system. And the question is, are we open-minded enough to allow that paradigm shift to happen? See, the germ theory is interesting for a lot of historical reasons, one of them being that one of the reasons the British Empire military forces did so well around the world was that they had less diarrhea than the French forces or the Spanish forces or the Portuguese forces. And one of the reasons they had less diarrhea was that their paradigm of disease modeling was based on the idea that in the miasma theory, it wasn't the magical gas that gave you disease. It was the odor that gave you disease. And so they built their latrines far away from their camps because they felt the odor was bad for us, whereas the French actually didn't do that. They built them right in the middle of the camps. And so they got less diarrhea just accidentally. All right. So again, this strange how we shape and form and our belief systems really affects, you know, the kinds of choices we make in public health. And then the political forces also come into it. We didn't know about vitamins back in those days, but we knew about scurvy, and scurvy is treated and prevented vitamin C. So there's a long history of scurvy. I won't go too deep into it. But the reason the British were called limeys is because they used limes on their ships to prevent scurvy. Limes are not the best source of vitamin C. Lemons are a better source of vitamin C. But they couldn't get lemons because all the places where they grew lemons, they were at war with. Right? So in many ways, their political system and their economic system, and in many ways, their value system, prevented them from adopting a public health set of beliefs and systems that may have changed their entire health sector. Anyway, off on a tangent. Next slide, please. Again. So the Copernican shift is the classic case of it's not the world is flat, but does the sun go around the earth or the earth go around the sun? That's probably the biggest paradigm shift in science that we can think of. Next. Newton's truth I mentioned. Next. Relativity, that was great. Next. Quantum mechanics, that we're actually in the era of a dramatic paradigm shift from relativity to quantum mechanics. And quantum mechanics, by the way, is the most proven set of physical theories in the history of science, because my cell phone would not work or exist. These computers would not work or exist. Our entire technological civilization would not work if not for the truth of quantum mechanics. And yet what it says is mind-boggling. Next, please. Multiverse, forget that. Next. Miasma theory, that was great. Next. One more. Cell theory, we had that already. Next. Evolution, that was a great one. Next. Okay, great. So So this distinction between qualitative and quantitative research represents a distinction in paradigms, right? So we're getting back to the same thing I talked about in the first couple of minutes. Qualitative research is exploratory. You cannot do it well without considering the role of value and belief and culture and psychology. Quantitative, we assume, can be done well without considering those things. I'm here to present to you that maybe that's not the case. All right, so you guys know all that already, so we can skip that slide. Okay, I got a lot of nonsense slides here. So the way that we define quantitative research, it's, you know, it can be exploratory, descriptive, or explanatory. In society, sweet coffee. In society, we tend to assume always that quantitative research wants to explain things. We're looking for causes. It's not enough to simply say, this percentage of Canadians smoke, okay, and maybe this percentage of Canadians have cancer. The mind naturally gravitates towards a causal relationship. Smoking causes cancer. We call that an ecological analysis, by the way. We know those are very poor kinds of studies. They don't really assess causality. But there is this thrust that the human animal wants to make relationships between variables, causal relationships. And so even we give passing credence to these first two, and which, of course, dominate what most students do and most researchers do. We usually describe and explore. We rarely explain. The last is what we always purport to do at the end of the day. And that's a bit problematic. Next, please. Next. All right. So, again, the difference between qualitative and quantitative research, you guys know this already, but, again, nice to go over them again. So one of them is subjective, inductive, meaning we take a little bit of information and we try to describe the universe. We don't mess with our subjects. We sort of, we let them come to us as they are. And we tend not to have a social distance between subjects or researcher and subjects. Not always. I mean, there are examples of qualitative research where the authority figure is important, right? Others where it's important that I be a peer and so forth. Whereas in quantitative research, we assume there is objectivity and we strive for deduction. Deduction is when I have sufficient information that is representative of the whole such that I can make conclusions about the nature of reality. We assume. And it doesn't really matter what the social distance is between the observer and the observed because it doesn't matter that I'm an authority figure or not. Your data is your data. Next, please. Okay, this is a graph that I made up to describe what I perceive to be the nature of research and how it breaks down. So there's a qualitative world, which is not this slide, which I don't really understand because I'm not a qualitative person. And then the quantitative world has two universes. The descriptive universe, which is what most of the lay population thinks about. When they ask them, let's say, hey, tell me about AIDS. They'll say, AIDS in America is mostly gay men. Or people in sub-Saharan Africa, and they get it from sex or from, you know, that's the kind of thing, descriptive stuff. An analysis occurs when we have two variables that are associating, at least two variables. So I can say one, two, three, four out of six students in this class, seven students in this class are female. Okay, that's a description. An analysis would be if you're female, you're more likely to be left-handed. So I've got two variables there. I've got the gender and I've got the handedness. So that's the subtle distinction there, right? Now, under my analyses, there are two kinds of approaches. There's the observational approach. Hopefully you guys are doing some of this in your studies, right? Where, I won't go into details of what these are, but the subtle aspects there is that an observational approach is I let the universe unfold and I observe and see what happens. Now, I can select who among the universe I will observe. And with this assumption of deductiveness, I'm going to select those individuals or populations based upon representativeness, I assume. Okay. But then there's experiment. Do you know what the defining characteristic of an experiment is? No. Yeah?
Controlling for everything else.
Sort of. No. I mean, that can be a characteristic. It's not the defining characteristic. No, that is hopefully a characteristic, but it's not a required characteristic. There's something about experiments that differentiates it from this set of things here. No. Well, even though you can't do what I'm explaining without a control. So you're all kind of on the same track.
Manipulation.
Ah, manipulation. So I said here, I let the universe unfold. And here, I'm going to mess with the universe and see what happens afterwards. So once the observer interjects himself and messes with the universe, suddenly it's an experiment. Now we've crossed over into that quantum world where I have done something to the experiment or to the thing that I'm studying. Now, have I affected it? Of course I've affected it. Now, hopefully I've planted the seed of doubt in your head about the conclusions we will make now, because I've created a degree of artificiality by affecting the universe. And yet I'm going to make conclusions about the universe or the world or my society that assume I didn't make those modifications or interventions. Now here, I've explained it in such a way that I suggest that the universe just happens. And I'm just, oh, look at you. That's great. Right? But even there, I've done something. I've selected who I'm going to watch. One assumes I've done so in a strategic way that minimizes bias. We try our best, but it's impossible to truly minimize bias. And hopefully I've got, do I have graphs? I don't know if I've got a graph to show you that. But the next slide, we can go back to this. Yes? Mm-hmm. Oh, that's a good question. Okay, so the RCT is a randomized controlled trial. We'll talk about that in a second. A quasi-experiment is something like if I have two populations, I have two cities, Ottawa and Toronto, and both of them are suffering from bad water, okay, and there's diarrhea everywhere. We don't know how to solve it. And I'm thinking, well, maybe if people learned about how to boil water, they would have less diarrhea. But I haven't got the ability or the time or the money to do a randomized control trial to prove that. So instead, I'm going to have a radio broadcast. And in Toronto, I'm going to buy time on the radio, and this radio show will tell people, if you boil water for 30 seconds, it'll prevent diarrhea. So then I watch and see if the rates of diarrhea decrease in Toronto more than the decrease in Ottawa, because Ottawa didn't get the radio broadcast. That's a classic quasi-experiment. The idea of a quasi-experiment is, I have still intervened. I've brought something to the experiment, that is my radio broadcast, but I didn't randomize. I didn't say, you're going to listen to it and you're not. I didn't control for a crossover. It's possible that someone drove from Toronto to Ottawa and said, hey, I heard this radio broadcast. You guys should do this shit. You know? So there's less control. Having said that, a quasi-experiment, immensely popular, especially in public health, especially in international health, because they're less expensive. And they're really useful in government for assessing impact of programs. For school programs, very common with this. So, hey, we're going to have this anti-sexual assault program in this school district and not over here. That's a quasi-experiment. I didn't randomize which students get access to it.
What do you see the main downside of quasi-experiment?
Lack of randomization, because we can't be assured of contamination, lack of contamination. That's why the sample size have to be huge. A natural experiment, on the other hand, is when it's a subtle distinction again. It's not that important what the distinction is, but the definition is that I didn't do the intervention, but somebody did, and I just happened to watch it. So it's a little unlike the observation studies where natural things happen and I watch it. Here, an unnatural thing happened and I watched it. Good examples are a natural disaster, which sounds like a natural thing, but for our purposes, we're saying it's an unnatural thing. Or the dropping of the bomb in Hiroshima and Nagasaki. That one always comes to mind because my very first job interview when I got my PhD was to be the epidemiologist for the Atomic Energy Commission. And I was so arrogant back then. So I got a physics background. I got a PhD in epi. Of course I had this job. And
It was.
Yeah, it was like God knows how many years ago. And I showed up at the interview, and the first thing they asked me is, tell us about an obvious natural experiment when it comes to radiation exposure in populations. And I had no idea because I didn't think it through. Obviously, a nuclear bomb. Right? And a lot of their data about population exposure comes from Japan. So I didn't get the job. I've since learned I never forget that example. So that's a natural experiment. We have this thing called, a natural experiment looks a lot like a cohort design where you're following something forward. The subtle distinction is I didn't do the thing. I didn't drop the bomb. He did, but I'm going to watch. I didn't cause the volcano to erupt. God did, but I'm going to watch. Right? Okay, next slide, please. All right. So the thing about paradigms is the idea of truth. So we have to ask ourselves, can truth be determined? Are we able to ask ourselves, will we identify truth if we see it? Does truth actually exist? Or do we have approximations of truth? And what evidence do you need to determine what is truth? Some people don't need a lot of evidence. And that says a lot about their biases. I'll give an example. I was at a dinner party once many years ago, and the woman next to me, she's on this anti-sex offender crusade, understandable. She says, "Do you know that every single man in jail for sex offense looked at porn?" And my response is, "Yeah, he probably ate bread also, right?" the argument being that she didn't have a control group to compare it to, right? She was not happy with that answer, and bad things happened. But in her case, her threshold for accepting truth was quite low, because she was ready to accept it. Where is our threshold for accept? Where do we set our evidence? So we go to statistics. We'll go into that today, but you know about statistics to some degree. Our p-value is set as if p is less than our alpha, and the alpha is usually 0.05 or 0.01, we say there is significance. Why? Why 0.05 or 0.01? Any ideas? There's no reason. Just historically, that was the cutoff. There is no reason whatsoever. That's a human choice. I'll give you another example of a human choice. What are the colors of the rainbow? Who knows them? Okay, Rojibiv, red, orange, yellow, green, blue, indigo, violet, 7 colors of the rainbow. Excellent. So you know that from a mnemonic you learned in public school. Right? It was you who said that, user? Okay, you get it. Your mouse not moving, so I can't tell. All right, so now answer honestly now. Before going through public school and learning that mnemonic, did you know what indigo was?
Well, blue.
Yeah, before someone told you that, though, could you have found indigo on that color scale? Right. Now, good for you for being honest. Now, most people, when you ask them, no, they don't know what indigo. I don't know what indigo is. But after going through high school and learning Roy G. Biv, we all, oh, of course, red, blue, indigo, violet, right? And if you ask chemistry teachers and public schools across America, they'll say, well, yeah, of course I see indigo. They're all along. Do you really see indigo? No, I don't. Most people only see 6 colors, but we say there are 7. There are actually an infinite number of colors in the rainbow, right? But we choose 6 or 7 because they're convenient. Do you know why we choose 7? Do you have any idea? Really? It's going to stun you. You ready for it? Sorry? Close. Because the person who gave us our 6 or 7 colors of the rainbow was Isaac Newton, who was the first man to look through a prism and see them. He knew intuitively, there are millions of colors here, but I see 6. But Isaac Newton was also a numerologist. He believed in arcane mystical forces, and he also believed the number 7 had important magical qualities. 7 days of the week, 7 angels on a pin, whatever it might be. So he said, well, there can't be 6 colors. There must be 7. I'll just insert indigo here. Okay? And here we are 200 years later, still teaching Isaac Newton's personal numerological value. Isn't that interesting? Right? There is no science there. There's no empirical evidence. There's one man's personal values that we just accept on faith. Anyway, move on. Next slide, please. Sorry?
How do you then define truth?
Oh, I'm not going to define truth. Or what I say is truth. You've heard of evidence-based medicine?
The question is, does it exist?
Right. Well, you've heard of evidence-based medicine, right? This is eminence-based medicine. So whatever I say is true. Next slide, please. Okay. So are things true at the print of the newspaper? Some people believe they are. What determines truth? Can different people hold different perception of what is true? Absolutely. And is one person right? Well, that's the crux of the argument. So we have political divides in this country that are quite profound right now. Two groups of people can see the same data and draw up starkly different conclusions. And that's based, again, on value. I believe it's incorrect to say that one is wrong as well and one is right. It's just that they're approaching the question from starkly different angles. Right. Next slide, please. So again, back to the power dynamic thought. It comes down to what is your responsibility as a researcher? So from the purely interpretivist perspective, one could argue that my responsibility is to collect the data, present it, quote unquote, objectively, and let the world decide. That is the classical Victorian sort of approach. And by the way, do you know what Isaac Newton called himself? He wasn't a scientist. I keep bringing up Newton because Newton really is considered to be the greatest scientist who ever lived, right? But he didn't call himself a scientist. You know what he called himself? You know? A natural philosopher. So the word scientist only entered our parlance over the last 100 years or so. So prior to this, most attempts to collect evidence and describe the universe were examples of philosophy. And Isaac Newton thought, as did much of his brethren, that according to my philosophy, my job is to look at the world, to present the data, to back away and, You, society, you deal with the ramifications. I won't, you know, that's not my job. But I would suggest to you that maybe we're entering a new era where it is our responsibility to consider the needs of society and to actually help society navigate the information that we present. So, should we remain neutral or objective? I don't know. But there's a strong movement now for researchers to be activists as well. So I've discovered this truth, as I perceive it, about the thing that I study. Is it now my responsibility to take action to enact positive change around that truth?
I think we had a discussion.
Did you already?
Yeah.
Fantastic. That's wonderful. Next slide, please. Okay, bias. We'll skip bias. Next slide, please. That's a whole different day. All right. So here is press the button again once. One more time. Okay. So if you think about the scientific method, hopefully you've covered some of this in public school and now again, right? Scientific method. Someone describe the scientific method for me. Remember what it is? It's amazing. Here we are, PhD scientists, and very rarely can we actually tell people what the scientific method is because we're not really taught it, except in like TV shows. So the scientific method really is you observe something happening, right? You observe. Yes. Then. Exactly. Exactly. It's exactly right. Okay. So here are some elements within the scientific method. So in your thesis, you've got your broad topic, right? You have a question to try and answer. You know, I'm looking at, I don't know, do fish like bread more than they like cheese? The hypothesis is, amongst this sample of fish fed 8 grams of this kind of cheese, will they respond more positively in terms of, you know, action versus fish that are fed 8 grams of bread? You know, so one more, please. Okay, that's where you do your analyses down here. I put statistics, but in your qualitative research, it'll be down there also, whatever analyses you put. The amazing thing here is even though all the work is done down there, you answer that. You answer your question, but the conversation you have is about that. Now, I present to you the possibility that maybe that doesn't represent that. But we use that as an excuse to talk about that. When you do your PhD defense, you'll find your examiners will talk about that endlessly. The boring ones like me will focus on that because, I didn't actually read it. And, oh, your methodology here is good. You use the stat? I don't know. But what the world cares about, what your paper will care about, what the publishers and the media will care about is that. And the flow of evidence is not rational here. To get from there to there, you're imbuing a degree of intellect, of sensitivity, of this machinery you call your brain and on all your education to draw inductive conclusions about the nature of the world based upon that. But we pretend, if it's a quantitative, like, okay, my PhD was in assisted reproduction. It was epidemiological. It was heavy stats, very, very positivist, right? And so I did some analyses on a small clinical group. And then the conversation I had was about the nature of assisted reproduction around the world and whether we're communicating it right and all that stuff. To go from that to that was an enormous leap. And it required, one could argue, it required me to bring in these other unrelated factors to give a cohesive whole to my strategy, or it required me to lie. So depending upon how you want to look at this, it goes either way. Right? I've got no problem talking about anything because I'm that guy now. I talk about everything and anything. Is it based on evidence? Probably not. But it's based on my experience around the world and the fact that I love hearing my own voice. Okay, but people assume it's based on evidence because I can do that. Okay, I'm getting a bit ahead of myself again. So go back to the scientific method. We have the observation, we have the hypothesis, the test, the conclusions, and then the larger interpretation. Most of that is mechanical, it's robotic. We can actually write a computer program to do most of that. But there are at least two components to that process which are value-driven. Do you see them?
Observation.
Almost. Next one down. Yes. And what's the second one? The second one that's value-driven. I'll tell you why in a second. Okay, we'll get into the details. So let's assume that the experiment, the testing was done okay. Let's assume that's done right. Because if you look at the classical science, it's Newton watching the apple fall. Cain says, ah, there's a force pulling the apple. Let's do an experiment where I drop apples all day and I measure them, I count them, and then I make a conclusion about, ah, there's a force pulling everything down. The answer is, the two elements are, he saw an apple fall. Where was this machine that allowed him to go from, I saw an apple fall, therefore there are forces applying on all apples? And then the second point is, I test my apples, therefore the moon is orbiting the Earth. So there are two magical moments there that had nothing to do with deductive reasoning. Yet we assume that example as being the classic perfect case of a positivist in deductive experience. But they weren't. They were value-driven. It was all of Newton's life experiences came into that moment where he says, the moon is falling just as this apple fell. Who does that? Had very little to do with the scientific process. Had everything to do with his personal genius and his experiences around the world. Anyway, next slide, please.
What is the key message here
for... Okay. The key message here is be aware that at the end of the day, you're going to talk about that. That we focus a lot on this, and that's important, right? For getting your classwork done and satisfying your supervisor, the testable hypothesis must be done appropriately and your methodology must be clear. You must answer your question. But what the world cares about is that. And I would hope that when you jump from the thing that you look at to the implications, it is done so in a sensitive, meaningful manner, fully cognizant of the fact that you are bringing in other experiences and other data and information that may not be part of your thesis. A good lesson? All right. All right, next, please. Answer that right next and discuss that. Yeah, next. All right, so you've seen this before? This is the pyramid of evidence. Okay, the pyramid of evidence is based on the assumption that the positive way of thinking is correct. So we say that the randomized control trial is the gold standard, and we'll talk about the randomized control trial in a second, of evidence. For a lot of reasons, it's controlled, it's randomized, it's less bias, you know. We say a systematic review of the best randomized control trials is even better evidence. And at the very bottom, personal experience. If I ask Dr. Yaya here, Dr. Yaya, so should I invest in this thing? He said, I think you should. I said, well, I can take his evidence, his opinion, or I can actually do the research myself. We argue that his opinion is the lowest kind of evidence. However, how do you think decisions are actually made? What's the order in which decisions are actually made? Flipped over entirely. Okay, nobody really cares about the quality of RCTs except as an example to roll up and bang on the desk. Look at this RCT, it says this, because you've already made up your mind at that point. Society cares more about personal opinion, which is why that what you discuss thing, it's so important. That allows you to have a personal opinion that has value. So,
that explains why most of the research that we do here is having hard time reaching decision-makers?
Yes, it does, actually. I'll repeat that question for the recording. The question was, does that explain why the research that we do has a hard time making decision-makers? Yes, it does. Because decision-making is not based on evidence. It's based on value, politics, agendas, and predetermination. So what you're looking for often is evidence that already supports what you want to do. Right, so I think there's I know Angel runs a little seminar here for her students that we simulate a parliamentary submission. I don't know if you guys would be part of that. I did it last year. I pretended to be the parliamentarian. The students came with proposals. We shot them all down because you don't satisfy my personal agenda. You didn't stop to think about what I need. It's not what society needs. It's what I need. Yeah. So again, when I worked for government, we had a model for how we did our reports. It's 25-5-1. That means you have a 25-page report on something, a 5-page summary for the boss, and a 1-page summary for the minister, right? Who would just really just roll it up in a piece of paper and bang it on the desk in the House of Commons. And then they'd say, write me a 25-pager on this. And it goes back down again. You write the 25-page. Because it was never about the evidence. It's always about the agenda. Okay. So does that sadden you? It should sadden you. But that's the way the world works. It's not based on this positivist assumption that deductive reasoning dictates reality. It does not. It's this other stuff that matters. The values, again, the personal relationships, whatever it might be. Next, please. Yes?
Are we moving top-down or maybe both directions?
I don't think we're moving at all. I think we're always down here. In my personal experience, I've never seen anything of value. I mean, we do this as scientists, and we tell ourselves it's important, and we get publications. But really, what people care about is this.
Our personal and expert opinion, they come from...
That's a good point. That's a very good point, is that this is not existing in a vacuum. It's informed by this. So in many ways, you could argue, and that's a very good argument, that maybe this should be the most important thing because it includes all of this. Yeah, that's a really good point. I never thought of it that way. Good for you. Next slide, please. Okay, so skip that. Sorry, already. Next slide. All right, so here are the randomized control trial. So we know what this is, but I'll go over it again anyway. This is, of course, the gold standard of evidence as we perceive it in the positivist framework. So we start off with, let's say I'm testing a drug about whether or not it cures migraines or treats migraines or reduces the incidence of migraine headaches. So we have a study population made up of people who are likely to get migraines. And I separate them out into two groups. Half are going to get my new drug and half are going to get a placebo. You know what a placebo is, right? A placebo is a thing that really resembles the drug in every way, the color, the shape, the size, the frequency of I'm taking it, except that it does not contain the active ingredient that I'm testing. So why do I randomize? I randomize this way. If you come to me, you're part of my study group, I flip a coin, you're there, you're there, and so forth. Why is that important to randomize?
To give everybody the same chance.
Yes, but why?
Because this is what natural life would be.
No, no, it's not.
But to eliminate the factors.
Ah, what factors?
Natural factors.
Individual.
Not yet, not that. Okay, think of it this way. We're dealing with a migraine drug, right? I know that women get more migraines than men. So if this group has more women than that group, this group is going to get more migraines any other day. And if this is the group getting my drug, artificially, it's going to look like the drug doesn't work. Okay, so I want to make sure that both groups get the same number of women. Maybe old people get more migraines than young people. So I want to make sure that both groups get the same number of old people, and so forth, and so forth. So for every factor that I know influences migraines, I'm going to make sure they're equally representative. What about the factors that I don't know? That's why we randomize, to assure the factors that I don't know about are probably equally distributed. Okay? That's key. Now, press the button again, please. That should be... Okay, the blinding is the next part of this. The blinding is when you don't know which drug you got. That's single-blinded and double-blinded is if I'm the investigator, I don't know what drug I gave you. Why is that important?
So that they don't think that something's happening when it's not, or think there's an effect and there's no effect, or vice versa for the investigator.
You're almost there. You phrase it wrongly.
Yeah.
Sorry?
Reduce the bias.
To reduce what kind of bias? What's going on here? What'll happen? Placebo. So what is that? So if you know that you're not getting the drug, what might happen? You're going to feel sicker, or think you feel sicker. Is there a difference between being sicker and thinking you feel sicker? Yeah, that's a right, right. Or if you think you're getting less migraines, right? Is there a difference between thinking you have less migraines and having less migraines? Is that not the same thing? Now, if I know I'm giving you a placebo, I may say, placebo, good luck. Or if I know I'm giving you, like, dude, you can't get this right on. Right? I can convince you that you are getting the drug. We know this. Okay? So we do this to take away all these factors. And this brings up the idea of placebo effect. And placebo effect, we tend to brush away, oh, that's just placebo effect. Placebo effect is huge. It's huge. So what I'm looking at is if this group gets this much positive outcome, and this group gets this much positive outcome, the difference is my effect size. And I say if the effect size is big, something great is happening. Let's say this one got this much positive outcome, and this one got this much positive outcome. My effect size is that much. It's still a lot, right? But look at that. Oh, my God. That's huge. These people got better from nothing. That's huge. We don't talk about that because we are so focused on the effect size. Why are we focused on the effect size? Because that's what's meaningful for the investigator, to show that this intervention has some additional value. Whereas I would argue it may just be as interesting to show that I can make these people well from nothing. So the point of a randomized controlled trial is that we are trying – your time's already good. We are trying to remove all the biases such that we are only testing this one important element in my intervention. In this case, it's the active ingredient in my pill. So if we do a randomized controlled trial for a lot of alternative therapies, like homeopathy, like Reiki, like all this stuff that I think is nonsensical, to be honest, we get zero results. We find that those interventions actually have no impact. Is there an argument that the randomized controlled trial is not an appropriate measurement of the effectiveness of those therapies? Do you see the argument? What is it? Okay, that's the first argument. What's the second argument? So to answer that, first of all, yeah, but the society may say, yeah, but I don't want to pay for a placebo effect. I can get, you know. Okay, you don't pay for it. So what's the other argument, that maybe this approach is inappropriate for some of these alternative therapies? Let me back up and say, when we talk about alternative therapies, there is social value and how we construct that too. Alternative tends to be non-Western, tends to be feminine, tends to be low income. Traditional or orthodoxy interventions tend to be Western, they tend to be high income, they tend to be masculine, right? And I'm actually one of these people who doesn't like alternative therapies. So for me to say this to you requires a lot of truth on my part. So is there an argument again that alternative therapies are not appropriate for RCTs? Think of it this way. Ever been to an acupuncturist or a Reiki healer or one of these people? Anybody? No? If you go there, what happens is you show up, someone's very nice to you, there's a nice room, they give you a cup of tea, they explain the process, or you lay down and say, are you doing okay? I'm doing fine. That's great. They do the thing on you, right? Then afterwards, you have another cup of tea and you sit up and you have this conversation, you go home and you feel great. If I do the randomized controlled trial, what am I testing? I'm testing the actual needles in my face. I am not testing the experience. Exactly, right? So the argument is often that the intervention for alternative therapies is not the actual drug or thing they're doing, it's the social context of it all. And that's stripped away when we take out these biasing effects. So those therapies will always fail a randomized controlled trial. So a lot of the, I think it's Boston, I could be wrong, where the publicly funded hospital system funds Reiki treatment, Reiki training for nurses, which I think is ridiculous. But they based it on a series of studies that showed that patients really enjoy the process. Not that the process is actually beneficial medically, but the patients enjoy it. Fair enough. Okay? Because the patient enjoy it, that's all I meant. What they're actually enjoying is the contact with the nurses. Reiki, by the way, is when I heal you like this. Okay? It's physiologically nonsensical. But there it is. Okay, so the idea is because I'm spending time with him, he feels better about himself. Nothing wrong with that. So that would always fail an RCT. So some part of how we define effectiveness in treatment in public health, where we throw our money and so forth, is based upon these structures that maybe are biasing against some softer, less intensive, less invasive therapies, which may be just as effective, but for non-medical reasons.
Yeah. And this is based on values, I guess.
Exactly, based on values. Okay, next slide, please. Okay, so so here's a classic question. I was asked by a consulting company in Washington many years ago to join them, and my job would have been to consult two law firms that represented evil companies who were being sued by clients they had harmed. And my job would be to defend the evil people. And it would have been easy. I would have been a scientific hitman. So an example would be a tobacco company being sued by someone who got cancer. And the lawyers would have trotted me out, and I would have said, well, there's no evidence that tobacco causes cancer, in the strictest sense of the word. I didn't take the job, right? I didn't take the job, but the joke I always make is, if I had taken the job, how would I have slept at night? And the answer is, on a bed of money. It would have been nice. But I didn't. It's not too late, I guess. But how do you think – I have a little bit of – how do you think I would be able to make that argument? In the case of tobacco, it's the classic example. What is the evidence that tobacco causes cancer? What do you think the evidence is?
It's a statistic evidence.
Okay, what kind of statistic evidence? Based on what kind of study? We talked about some studies here.
Analytic studies.
Yes, what kind? Some case controls, yes. So a case control study would be, I get some people with cancer, some people who don't have cancer, and I ask them, did you smoke? And I see which has a high proportion. Okay? What else could I have done? It's always that. Yeah, that's the best kind. We can't do RCTs. Why can't we do RCTs? Ethics, exactly. I can't take a bunch of five-year-olds here and a bunch of five-year-olds here. You smoke a pack a day for the next 20 years and you don't, right? And I can't control their lives, so this group doesn't live near a smokestack or something else. I can't do that. So therefore, ethically and practically, it is impossible to get the best quality evidence to prove that smoking causes cancer. Therefore, an asshole epidemiologist like me could go to court and say, you can't prove this guy got cancer. There's no way. Luckily, the court systems saw better. Now, it took a paradigm shift in the legal system to come around to accept this level of data and evidence, because finally it was aligned to social value that was ready to punish companies for their wrongdoing. So the paradigm shift is not just in science. It was in society. It was in law and everything. There happened to be a magical sweet spot in, I guess it was the 70s or 80s, that allowed these law cases to come to fruition. So finally, now we hold these companies to accountability. Right? But the scientific soft spot or vulnerability was in the RCT. Again, the positivist approach solved nothing. Okay? It was fraught with bias. It's fraught with holes. What was needed was a larger discussion of the roles of companies and responsibility and so forth. Okay, next slide. That's the next slide here. Okay, here. It's interesting. What's a valid placebo? So you probably know about when we design RCTs, it's not just – oh, here we go. I said we have a placebo very often. So the placebo looks like the pill but doesn't have anything. If my drug is a life-saving drug, if you're all dying of cancer and I've got this thing that I think might save you, is it ethical to give you a placebo? No, it isn't. So what do I do instead? Right? So if you are all, well, not necessarily. So if you're all cancer patients, and I have this new drug that I need to test to see if it cures cancer, I'm going to randomly take half of you and give you my new drug. For the other half, what will I do? The alternative therapy, the common therapy, the one that's currently accepted. That's our safe way out. Now, so, and ethically what we say is we don't care if this drug is better than nothing. What we care is it better than the thing we currently have. So that's the way out. So a lot of the lay people don't understand that. You guys get that right away. Breaking the seal is what we say when we halfway through a study, I actually say, this guy is getting better faster than I thought. Let's find out if he's taking the placebo or the drug. We break the seal, open his file. He's on the drug, right? Why would I do that? Yeah.
I think there's an ethical imperative to give it to everybody if it's working dramatically well early on.
That's one argument. That's probably the most common argument. That's another one. Is, hey, it's working really well. It's like, get this thing to market really fast. Let's ramp up the study now. Yeah? Or if he's doing really poorly, we got to break out and see, like, is he on the placebo? Or if he's on the drug, then maybe the drug is causing him to do poorly. That's the ethical argument. Right? So more than not, I would say it's ethics that – cause us to break the seal, but there is a financial component sometimes as well. Next slide, please. Okay, so this is an example. We have an RCT for a new treatment for depression. So what kinds of people do you recruit if you're doing an RCT for a depression drug? People who have depression, okay? What kinds of people with depression? So depressed people who are profoundly depressed probably aren't going to be able to participate in a long-term RCT. They're not going to be reliable. So next slide, please. Okay. So people are depressed, but not too depressed because they have other, you know, if you're depressed, maybe you're suicidal, maybe you're bipolar, all these other factors. The next one. But if not depressed enough, well, maybe they're sad, you know. So where's the clinical cutoff? So next slide. There was actually a study, a real study. 22% of people qualified for the actual RCT, right, of all the people that were screened. And yet the findings for that study are extrapolated to be relevant to the entire population. So we siphon down a relevant sample, and yet we talk about the whole world based upon this very specialized sample that was, in, you know, may not be representative of the profoundly depressed or the mildly depressed. It's a failing of positivist science. We make the assumption, we communicate that this is the best possible evidence, but it's not. It's not representative of most people. The same thing happens when we talk about some, for the longest time, AZT, the anti-HIV drug, was only tested on men, but was prescribed to women. The assumption being that women have the same physiology as men. It's not true. All right? So again, value and assumptions interwoven through all of this. Next one, please.
But this has huge implications when it comes to public health.
Oh, totally, right. So almost, not I'm going to say all, but a lot of evidence that we use in public health is based upon hidden assumptions like this. And it's unknown to what extent the lack of investigation into these assumptions is what's responsible for some of the lack of effectiveness in our programming. What I find interesting, though, is despite it all, there is this lay and policy bias towards accepting the RCT and the positivist philosophy represents as being sacrosanct, as being this religious almost perfection of science.
What would explain that? Lack of resources, lack of time, lack of...
No, it's the logic. It's actually the design. It's the fact that we are told all the time that we want a sample that it has the best possible chances of compliance and of completing the study and all that stuff. And that, and with all these strict requirements of quality that we add on all the time actually reduces the representationalness, that a word, the ability for our sampling representational. And that's actually probably reflective of the problem with the RCT in general. It's such a rarefied model that it doesn't reflect the real world. It's a bias. It's, I forgot what the bias is called. Ecological bias. No, it's called early in the morning, where we spend so much time making this pristine environment that when the drug goes wild, it's not relevant anymore. Right. So if we're testing this migraine drug in a clinical environment, we make sure you're not taking alcohol and all this other stuff, and you know, we make sure that both groups have equal access to support systems. When it goes wild, that's not the real world. I suffer from migraines. Like when I get a migraine, I gotta think fast. If I take a shot of alcohol right now, let's bust some caffeine, maybe I'll slow it down, then I'll take my drug later on. So in the real world, all kinds of factors are playing in. So the RCT is not relevant in many cases. Again, I'm not an expert in this. There are people who have written endless books on how the RCT may or may not reflect reality. But it's a problem that we very rarely talk about when we make the translation from research to policy. Yeah. Next slide, please. Okay, I love this example. This is a photograph I took in the Toronto subway. You can't see it, but it says, did you know that 86% of HIV-positive Canadians are male and two-thirds of boys aged 15 to 19 are sexually active? You think your kids aren't at risk? Think again. I stared at this thing for like half an hour. I'm glad you guys are laughing. This was like 4 years ago, 3 years ago. So you see the problem, right? If you see it, put up your hands and tell me what the problem is. Yeah?
It's like saying, I like oranges and the sky's blue. Like
thank you. Thank you. It's a joy talking to PhD students. When I present this to undergrads or lay pop, I go, I don't see the problem. Okay, so next slide. Let's break it down now. So the problem is these three sentences have nothing to do with each other. All right? You see that now. So let's break it down further. Next slide. Okay, so if we actually do the calculation, as I make my undergrads do, you know, we find 58,000 people living with HIV, we use their statistic, we realize they're talking about male, not men, so they're throwing in, you know, young people. So we actually look up the numbers, next slide please, and we get, also what kind of sex, is it heterosexual, homosexual, protected, unprotected, is it whatever, is it penetrated, we don't know. These are all stats you don't care about, so next slide please. So when you do the math, you get the risk of people currently with HIV who likely got it from sex is 0.13% in Canada, 0.13%. But they say the number 86%. Why do they cite 86%? suits their interest. It's a much larger, impressive number. God, that's evil. Isn't that evil? That's public health. Right? This drives me crazy. So next slide. So is it intentional duplicity? Or is it a communications error? Is it like I like the idea of giving them a way out? Is it in a case of an NGO saying, oh, we got to cite the biggest number to scare people and to get our funding? Or is it a case of maybe someone didn't call the epidemiologist in the department, right? Very often, organizations I've dealt with, the communications people have no relationship with the actual science people. Is it that case? I don't know. Next slide. Right. So here the possibility, or is it just bad science? I believe, because I'm a conspiracy nut, is it's a case of trying to justify the funding. So CanFar needed funding. Hey, look, 86%. Oh, your kids are at risk. No, they're not. They're not at risk of anything. Kids are fine. And let me tell you, when I bring this up, I get in so much shit. Public health people just hate when I talk about this. There's another – do I have – next slide. See if I have another example here. This is not an example. This is a good one, though. So this is an ad by the Ernest T. Women's Shelter, and it says here that 3 to 5 children in every Canadian classroom have witnessed their mother being assaulted. Okay, that's bad, right? The question I ask then is that a lot? I don't know. Obviously, any is too high, but
3 to 5, so that depends on what is happening.
Depends on a lot of things. And 70% of men in court-ordered treatment for domestic violence witness it as a child. Okay, that's a high number. What's the next question you ask when you see that? 70% of men who are domestic abusers witness it as a child. Sure, that would be the policy angle. What is the science angle? That's a good question to ask. That's not the one that I jump right at. See, these numbers, they're duplicitous because they don't report the control group. Maybe every man witnesses as a child. maybe the population of men not in court-ordered treatments for domestic violence is actually the same as 70%. Maybe it has no effect. I'm not saying these are good things. I'm just saying scientifically, this doesn't tell us anything. So you press the button again. I think I've got some other side here. So the message is simple. There appears to be an association between observing domestic abuse and perpetrating it. That's what they're trying to say. But the data does not confirm that. So next. Okay, I got guts. So the implication is that we're trying to push for policy change based on this data. And next. Right, next again. I think we covered this already. What percentage of men not in court treatment? Need to answer. Next slide. I've got all the stuff that kind of slides in. All right, next. Okay, so was it wrong for them to have done this? Right, what was the purpose of the ads? Was the purpose of the ads to educate? If it was to educate, it kind of failed because it was duplicitous. Was it to compel behavior change? Probably. Was it to raise awareness? Maybe. Awareness of what? Of bad stats? I don't know. Of a problem? Maybe. To secure funding? I like to think that's probably the case. To justify funding, that's also the case. So the funding they're currently getting. I think what's actually happening is that no one has a strategy of why they're doing it and how they're doing it. They say they know that this is important to them and we need to produce content, but there isn't a process if they were to come out and say that I'm doing this to get funding, I'd actually respect that level of evilness. It shows that there is at least a thought process, yeah?
Elizabeth Pisani talks a lot about
What's her name again? Elizabeth Pisani? Okay, thank you.
And she's actually very honest about it and very evil about it. She calls it beating up the numbers. But she actually has provided some compelling arguments for why, in that context at that time, it did seem like an ethical thing to do. Because there was programming through NGOs that dealt with a lot more than condoms. It dealt with social context. Mm-hmm. It was really edgy and exciting and talking about capacity building in a much broader way. But then to get, as you say, funding, to get resources to continue it, they could not get any attention. So what they did was very deliberately beat up the numbers to bump their priority on political agendas so that they could get their funding to continue their work that wasn't recognized. So it was a deliberate
right.
Because there was no paradigm shift at that level. So they used a positive paradigm to make a case.
See, this is what I'm getting at.
But
yeah.
Still BS because that was all false information out there.
Right. It's the reliance upon the sacrosanct nature of positivism to sell your goods, right? You hang your hat on the fact that people respect science and you steal their verbiage. I don't have enough time. I've got endless examples of I've got one example that I didn't share this time of an anti-climate change paper written to Wall Street Journal. It's not peer-reviewed, but it looks peer-reviewed. It's got intro methods results, right? It's got stats and everything, but it's in the Wall Street Journal. What they've done is stolen the veneer of peer-reviewed positivist science to push forward a political agenda. So even though positivist science is value-stricken, it's perceived as being objective and deductive. Therefore, its power is stolen all the time. So was that a hand, Becker?
Yeah, just share some yeah. Lines. Like, I come from a university with HIV/AIDS. And what you see is really the statistics that are given are really mind-boggling.
Yeah.
I remember at the beginning of the HIV epidemic in Uganda, they said the statistics show that 30% of the population had HIV/AIDS. But actually, what happened was that this statistic was taken from one sentinel cell.
Ah, right.
And
generalized, right? Yeah.
But you see, it's not really okay. It's not really deliberate because actually, at that time, the thing was, it was a crisis, and that was the assumption, and this was put upon to the interventions as well.
Mm-hmm.
So what was really, the idea was, one of the purposes was really to compel behavioral change, you know?
Right.
And it was to impose such a kind of fear that this...
See, I mean, I respect the motivation, but it's kind of like the war on terror. You scare people into compliance, and that to me ultimately is failing. You know, another example of this, and this is not intentional, but about 10 years ago in Ontario, media reported that the cases of cholera in Ontario had doubled. Doubled! Went from 2 cases to 4. Yeah. That was a case of media just not getting the absolute numbers, you know?
This, as you mentioned, this is shaped by values.
Right.
I mean, media will know bring stories. Because they know that no society will love those type of stories.
Yeah. It's worse now, the internet age, when you have the most inciting headlines, so if you click on it just to get to the story, which is actually kind of boring because they get money every time you click on it. So they get, it's called clickbait. You know, so now it's worse than ever before. Running out of time, so next slide, if we can get through this. Okay, so I love the story. This is a story about breatharianism. Breatharianism is a kind of inedia. What are those things? Those are movements where people claim to live without eating. Okay, the anthropology of this is fascinating. So it pops up a lot in India in times of famine. So in a place where there isn't a lot of food, the most holy thing you can be is someone who lives without eating. So every now and then, some guy pops up and says, I don't eat at all. Look at me, I'm fine. Okay. So this guy, his name is Prahlad Jani. He popped up a few years ago and claimed to be in his 70s, never having eaten or drunk in his entire life. He says, in his childhood, he was blessed by a goddess who gave him a secret organ in his palate that drips a nectar into his body. It's not there, whatever. So, because the Indian military decided to run quote unquote trials on this man to determine whether or not his claims are true, because they wished to use his technology to avoid feeding their troops. Right? So they got this doctor to run experiments on him, and they published the results on their website. And the results said that they observed him for 2 weeks, he didn't eat or drink, and not only did he not die, he gained weight. So this magazine contacted me and said, please debunk this nonsense. To me, it was easy to debunk it, so I didn't bother debunking it. Instead, I suggested the following. I said, let us say, by the way, if you had to debunk it, what would you do? Well, how would you criticize those findings?
You bring him here in your... You leave him outside?
It's actually fairly easy, and it begins with the obvious way to debunk something is look at who the examiner is, first of all. So the doctor running the trial actually is a follower in the cult in which this guy's a leader. So that's the first problem. Second, none of this is peer-reviewed. Third is the protocols are poorly described, and among them where there's a camera on the guy, and they turn off the camera for an hour for a day each day for his privacy. Right. Yeah, he doesn't drink, but he pours massive gallons of water over his head every day. But he's pretty drinking it. He has visitors unescorted who probably smuggle in food. You know, it's nonsensical. The list goes on and on and on. But what I said instead was, let's say that he did everything that we as epidemiologists and as scientists perceive to be the proper positivist quantitative methodology for assuring control over this environment. And let us say that even after establishing these proper controls, he still gained weight. What do you conclude then? And I opened this up to the magazine's readers, and the hate mail I got was tremendous, mostly from doctors. Right? And the hate mail was of – can you guess what the hate mail was? Can you guess what they're saying? Well, I'll tell you. What they're saying was, if you had run this trial properly and found that he gained weight, clearly you didn't run it properly because that is physiologically impossible. There it is. There it is. And it was such a struggle pointing that out, that if you're going to assume the conclusions to begin with, why bother doing the experiment? Okay? So you must be open-minded enough to accept the outcome of your study. And that to me is the sign of a mature investigator is, are you profoundly humble enough to suggest maybe my assumptions about the nature of reality are not real? Now, in the case of epidemiology, these examples pop up all the time because every human characteristic falls on the normal distribution. There's always going to be someone on the extremes. The question is, if you repeat this several times, do you get the same result or is it an outlier? But even if it happened once, even if you get one guy who can live without eating, oh my God, that's amazing. That violates the laws of thermodynamics, right? And this has happened historically, again, with the paradigm shifts, relativity and quantum mechanics. These shifts happen. Maybe medicine is due for a kick in the ass. Maybe public health is due for a kick in the ass to say there are assumptions about the nature of reality, or at the very least about the nature of how we assess evidence is due for a reconsideration.
Right? Do that, no, during your PhD thesis.
You'll be in big trouble. Do not do this for your thesis. No. You do everything traditional in your thesis, then get the hell out and start a career.
That's the problem as well within Norway.
Yes.
Institutions. I mean,
yeah.
We are not trained to question.
Not just in institutions, but you know, in the infrastructure of science investigation as a whole, as I found writing this article, you know, is that people just come after you. How dare you question our assumptions? And then your target is being Alvarez was a geologist who first proposed that a meteor impact killed off the dinosaurs. Okay, he was ridiculed. He died as an outcast. After his death, it was shown that he was right. A meteor impact did, in fact, kill off the dinosaurs. So now he is celebrated as being a grand thinker, but not in his own lifetime. Right? So he's, even in, you know, this is like 25 years ago, not that long ago, it was my lifetime. So very often the world is not ready to accept a paradigm shift. In physics, we're all about paradigm shifts. When I was in physics, it was great. Every week someone had a new idea. Yeah, bring it on, it's great. Because our asses have been kicked so often, you expect it now. But in public health and medicine, it's still a touchy topic. But what I hope is that this generation of researchers is a bit more open-minded and can perceive maybe the value in out-of-the-box thinking. Do I have any more slides? Let me see. Okay, this guy's interesting. If you want to go to a TED Talk, this guy's an interesting TED Talk. His name is Pathanak. He talks about doing business in India. And I've got 5 minutes. This is the TED India in Bombay a few years ago. And he tells a wonderful story. He uses Alexander's march to India as an example. How when Alexander the Great went to India, he met a Jain mystic who was sitting by the water. And Alexander asked him, "What are you doing?" And Jain mystic says, "Nothing. I'm sitting here contemplating nothing. What are you doing?" I was like, "I'm here to conquer the world." All right, good luck. So, and they both went their separate ways, thinking the other one was an idiot. Okay? And the reason is that in Alexander's frame of reference, he lives one time, and he must be a hero that one time. He's got to conquer the world and be put in immortality in the stars, remembered forevermore. In the Jain mystic's worldview, he lives over and over again. What's the point of conquering the world? Because this new world pops up all the time. So depending upon your worldview, your paradigm, your set of beliefs and values and systems, how you approach investigation is going to be different. And very often we have a problem with those two worldviews colliding and interfacing. Next slide. Right, and then there it is. And I think that's the last slide is do we see values reflected here in this particular version of hierarchy of evidence? And yes, there is value, obviously. In every step of the way, there's value. That's the end of it. Do I have one more slide? I'm not sure. No, I don't. Good. 3 minutes left. Any comments, questions, complaints, jokes? Yeah. How are you impacted? You're impacted by the assumptions you make and by the conclusions you make and by your personal belief system, in my opinion. So how do you know that the drug that you take tonight for your stomach ache works? Right? That's as a personal consumer. You're assuming these things have been vetted around the world. Second of all is the assumptions you make about other people and what they do. I make fun of homeopathic people all the time. I think homeopathy is a stupid, stupid fake science. But I'm aware that that's based on my value system, and it's a horrible thing for me to do. Because people encounter these systems, honestly, with an expectation of being well, and how dare I criticize their path through life, right? So it affects who we are as human beings. Now, as researchers, it affects us in the ways in which we assess evidence, extrapolate to conclusions, and recommend policy. How's that for a long-winded answer? So I'm going to put this recording, hopefully it's still recording, let's find out, on my website if you want to hear it again. And with these slides as well, I'll put them on there.